words, I think that when we said some years ago that this, that we were entering into the most turbulent period in history, I believe that perhaps some comments thought this may be a bit of an exaggeration. I don't think anyone would say that now. We are facing the most explosive situation, certainly since the 1930s, with, and the main characteristic that we predicted, which is now a fact, it's not a prediction, it's not a perspective, it's a fact, is enormous turbulence, a chaotic situation, really, at every level. Economic turbulence, financial turbulence, social turbulence, political turbulence, military turbulence, in an absolutely explosive cocktail that's being prepared. And faced with this situation, what is striking is that Trotsky's phrase comes to mind when he referred to the bourgeoisie tobogganing to disaster with their eyes closed. What is striking is the complete panic and confusion and disorientation of all the strategists of capital, starting with the economists. They just don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. This was not supposed to happen. They now admit, the same people that systematically denied any possibility of a recession, never mind about a slump, they're now talking about the perspective of a depression, and they've no idea, they've entered uncharted, they've no idea the scale of this. Now I'm going to pass around for you this chart, which is absolutely staggering. When you refer to the proportions of the banking crisis, this graph compares the loss of market values over the last, I think, 12 months or 18 months. Just have a look at the figure for the Royal Bank of Scotland and compare it, for example, to the Bank of Santander. Santander lost about half of its market value. And under normal circumstances, if a big bank lost half of its market value, you'd think that would see this. But just have a look at the second circle, see the form of circle. Normally, I don't like graphs, but this, I think, says it all. This is an astonishing state of affairs. And now, of course, it's reached the real economy. You see, one by one. First of all, they denied that it was going to take place at all. You remember the new economic paradigm. Then they said when it started in the United States, the so-called subprime crisis, oh, it's only for America, it's only the American, it won't affect the rest of the world. Completely contradicting everything they said previously about globalization. You must think that people are complete fools. They contradict themselves, and they don't even bat an eyelid when they contradict themselves. The most astonishing thing. Then they said, "Oh no, it's only the banking. It's only financial crisis. It's only the banking sector." Well, that's clearly not the case. Then they said, "Ah yes, but it's only part of the world will be affected." First of all, they said that Europe wouldn't be affected, and that's that particular illusion. That bubble has been pricked. Then they said, and this was the main argument they put forward. Well, deal with that later on in my opening remarks. Asia will save us. China will save us. We'll deal with that. I'll give the figures. One or two things to deal with. The fact of the matter is now that this is a global recession, the most serious crisis since the 1930s, and nobody knows where this is going to end. And it's a crisis of the real economy. They call a spade a shovel. It is a classical crisis of overproduction. What Marx said even in the Communist Manifesto, never mind about capital. There is a crisis because there's too many cars. You just saw what happened with Honda. Too much steel. Too many houses. Too many houses for all the homeless people. The fact is that the bourgeois system, the market, can't absorb this production. That's the fact of the matter. In other words, this shows the fundamental contradiction of capitalism that Marx explained. It's a crisis of the real economy. The last 12 months, the last year, the USA lost officially 3 million jobs, which is the worst figure for 60 years. The bourgeoisie and the establishment, they're in a state of shock. They don't know what to do. And this is the stormy background upon which world perspectives is now unfolding. Now into this scenario steps the hero of the hour, not Brother Gordon, I think his hour is well past, but the new hero Obama, he reminds me a bit, you know, of Woodrow Wilson, that appeared to be the hero, that was going to solve all the problems with his famous 14 points. I'm doing an article about the Versailles Treaty. It's the anniversary, the 90th anniversary this year. All the illusions, particularly of the petty bourgeoisie, but also the bourgeois, have illusions. They're illusions. They're going to solve all the problems. This great hero coming from across the sea, hands across the sea, is going to solve all the problems. Incidentally, we must make a point here, although we understand clearly that there is no fundamental difference between Obama and Bush. No fundamental difference. I didn't say no difference at all. There is a difference, as a matter of fact, as we will see. However, this man comes forward. We know that the illusions will be shattered eventually, not immediately, by the way. But the first point that we have to recognize: this is a political earthquake. It's a seismic change in the United States. Who can doubt it? Here was a country where people did not vote. Nobody voted in elections. Nobody took the slightest interest in elections. And here you had people queuing up before dawn. Ordinary people, many of them were black, but not only black, ordinary people that never participated in politics, queuing up to vote for Obama. Now, what in fact were these people queuing? What did they want? What did they desire, fervently desire? It was a passion. The people were in tears. What did they desire? Yes, of course, many black people saw the election of a black man and so on. It's a factor, and it is an interesting point. But the bourgeois commentators made the point that people here, the question of race wasn't raised. People weren't into it. It was mainly the economical question that they were concerned about. And the general crisis of society and the wars and so on and so forth that this man is supposed to resolve. But really speaking, in their heart of hearts, what the masses in America were trying to achieve is change. You have to, they said this when they were, what do you want? You want to change. We're fed up with this. And we want to solve the problem of unemployment, and we want to solve people losing their homes, and we want to solve the war in Iraq, and they think that Obama is going to do this. Of course, he will not. However, as I said, it's not correct to say that Obama is the same as George Bush. He is not. Within the ruling class, there's always different strata and different strands. And that's also true in America. There's a different style. George Bush represents the most obtuse. I don't know what the cartoonists are going to do now. Well, they'll find a way out of this. As the capitalists, they usually find a way out of every situation eventually. But George Bush represented the most obtuse, the most reactionary, the most retrograde, the most provincial, the most ignorant, the most obscurantist wing, which has always been present in America, the far west, the backwards men and so on, and so forth, the Republicans and so on. Obama's different. Obama is a far cleverer, far slicker politician. So there's a difference in style, which has got a certain thing. But also, he's facing a different objective situation. This is not the 11th of September. And that's finished. That's receded into the past now. And the idea that America could throw its weight around the world and just go in like a bull in it or an elephant in the China shop, that's also finished. Even the thickest elements of the American ruling class have understood this cannot continue. And as we predicted, you see, I predicted this in the writings on Gaza, and even previous to that, I said that with Obama. I said the first thing he's going to do is to enter into discussions with Iran. Now that's precisely what's occurred. Although the Iranians, I also predicted that. They say, no, we can't be bothered with this. We're not talking to you. Well, they will talk. I'll predict that. They will talk to them. Probably in secret they are talking and have been talking for some time. Why? Because Obama must withdraw the American forces from Iraq. And as we explained, in order to do this, he must open negotiations with Syria and with Iran. This has been perfectly evident for some time. The war in Iraq has failed. We must deal with world relations to some extent. Because there's been a change in world relations, which shouldn't be a surprise to us. The war in Iraq has failed. Let's remind ourselves what the declared aims of the war were. First of all, it's supposed to be part of the war against terror. Well, what's occurred? Has it stopped the question of terrorism? On the contrary, there's been an enormous increase now in terrorist moods among the youth, particularly in the Islamic world. More atrocities, more attacks, and there will be more terrorist actions, which shows desperation. What it really shows is, on the one hand, the impasse of capitalism, which offers no solution to particularly young people in the so-called Islamic countries. On the other hand, the lack of the subjective factor. In the past, after all, in the Middle East, there were powerful communist parties, so-called communist parties, which betrayed the revolution, and therefore you have this development of fundamentalism. It's a reflection of despair, as a matter of fact, and the lack of the subjective factor, which is something that we have to look at. But Trotsky explained, you see, that in any situation, in any country, and now it's not a country, it's the entire world, in any country, in any society where terrorism is endemic, that shows that this country is in an impasse. It's precisely a reflection of the impasse. The attempt to solve this by barging into Iraq and Afghanistan have been had the opposite effect. It's increased terrorism. Al-Qaeda didn't have a base in Iraq before. Now they have a base in Iraq. That's the simple fact of the matter. And all they've achieved is to enormously destabilize the whole of the Middle East, which will have serious consequences, and is having serious consequences from the standpoint of capitalism, and destabilize Central Asia. They destabilized Pakistan, for example, by barging around like an elephant in Afghanistan, where the British imperialists, by the way, they could never defeat the Afghans. The British army was actually defeated. I don't know if the communists know that. I think it was about the only time that a British army was defeated in battle by a colonial people in Afghanistan in the 19th century. Eventually, they had to do a deal with the tribal chiefs, bribe them, in effect. And they're quite, despite their Islamic rhetoric, they're quite open to a bit of bribery, these tribal chiefs, both in Iraq and particularly in Afghanistan. And that's what the Americans will be forced to do. They can't win. They can't win in Iraq, and they can't win in Afghanistan either. They'll be forced to withdraw. But in order to withdraw, they must prepare the ground. We predicted this. I don't mind the comments. And therefore, they've been forced to everything they swore they wouldn't do. Bush was actually talking about attacking. He wanted a war with Syria, if you can imagine such a thing. And he even threatened Iran, we said at the time that there's no way that we're going to invade Iran. That was nonsense, but he said it was madness, but this man was a little bit mad anyway, so you could expect that. Now they're forced to pull their pants down, in effect, and come and offer to negotiate, because unless they reach a deal with the Iranians in particular, how can they withdraw? They'd be in a mess, because the Iranians control a lot of the Shiite militias in particular. They could be attacked. It could end up like Saigon, which is something that they don't want to do. They are defeated, but they don't want it to turn into a rout, which it would be if they're not very careful. Now, of course, this has certain results. World politics, if you move one piece, it's like a game of chess. It is like a gigantic, monstrous game of chess. Except that instead of chessmen and chess pieces, you're dealing with the lives of whole people and whole nations. That's what you're dealing with. But it's just so much small change. For all of them, actually. It's just so much small change. Starting with the Palestinians. Small nations and the right of self-determination has always been small change in imperialist diplomacy. They use this for their own interests and their own purposes. Now, The Economist the Financial Times actually carried an interesting article written by strategists of capital. I've got the names of Richard Haas and Martin Indyk, I think they were. And they made the following very interesting remark on the 17th of December. They said the following. The U.S. can no longer achieve its objectives. They were talking about the Middle East, but it isn't just the Middle East. The U.S., this is the change. That's what I'm saying, there's a change. Situations change. And therefore, Obama's policies must change. The U.S. can no longer achieve its objectives without the backing of regional partners. So I'm talking about Syria and Iran, as well as China, Europe, and Russia. Now, that's a very interesting remark, which shows what? It shows a change in the world balance of forces, which is what I explained in my article about Georgia. The war over Georgia was the turning point, in my view, that the Russians said, now, girls and boys, draw a line in the sand, so far and no further with your nonsense. And this is an important change. Now, of course, Israel enters the Palestine question. Of course, this year, 2009, opened with an explosive event within you. What more explosive event do you want than the brutal invasion of the Gaza Strip by Israel? Now, what was the reason for this? Of course, you get all the pacifists and the petty bourgeois elements running around and expressing the usual shock and horror that people are being killed. And so, well, I have news for you, girls and boys. In a war, people get killed, actually. That is the purpose of the war. It is to kill people and to intimidate people. It wasn't genocide, by the way. This was used in agitation. So you can use that in agitation. You can use all kinds of words in agitation, which is an emotive question. But let's be clear about this. The purpose of the Israeli state was not to wipe out the Palestinians. That's nonsense. They killed 1,300 people, which is bad enough. Poor men, women, and children. And that, of course, had an enormous effect on world public opinion, particularly in the Arab world, and that will have an effect, a very serious effect. But you see, Marxists cannot afford to approach a serious question like war from a sentimental or moralistic point of view. Pacifism is just nonsense. And we have to determine very clearly what the war aims are, whose interest the war is. That's the only thing that concerns us. Never mind about the violence and the killing. There's always violence and killing. The question is, for what purpose? And in whose interests? And the basic position of Marxism is perfectly clear. There are just wars and there are unjust wars. Nothing to do with who fires the first shot or who's responsible or whether the Hamas was firing rockets. There's nothing to do with it. That was nonsense anyway. The rockets of Hamas serve no military purpose whatsoever. It makes one laugh. If it wasn't so serious, you just have to laugh about it. It's just a cruel joke. A joke in very poor taste. Oh, the armed struggle against China. What armed? I asked myself, what armed struggle are you talking about, my friend? What armed struggle? Chucking rockets, which you can't even aim them properly, at Jewish villages, which quite likely would end up by, they killed one or two civilians. Now, what military, what kind of an armed struggle is this? It's not an armed struggle at all. Did this do any damage to the Israeli state? It did not. Did it damage the Israeli army? It did not. Did it hurt the Zionists? No, it did not. It enormously strengthened Zionism, temporarily at least. It drives the mass of the Israeli people into the arms of the most reactionary elements. Because the conclusion that ordinary Jews are going to draw, Israelis are going to draw, is this. These people want to murder us. These people want to kill us. Therefore, we have to protect ourselves. You know, it's the ABC. You have to be a bit thick not to understand. Does that in any sense, shape, or form represent a struggle against Zionism? It does not. It assists Zionism, for goodness sake. It helps the Zionists, and it did help them. It gave them the excuses they required to implement a policy which was prepared well in advance, and it was nothing to do with these Hamas rockets. Nothing whatsoever to do with it. What was the purpose of it? First of all, I repeat what I said. The we're not pacifists. We don't approach war in a pacifistic or moralistic sense, which is just the trivial nonsense of the petty bourgeois idiots who understand nothing. Hegel pointed out a long time ago, all serious questions are solved by force throughout history. You don't like it? Well, I'm very sorry for you. You can spend the rest of your life studying the Sermon on the Mount and preaching to people. That's very nice. It doesn't solve anything. All serious questions in history are solved by force. You better wake up to the fact. And the only question which determines our attitude towards any given war or military conflict is this. Is this a struggle of the poor, oppressed people for their own rights against a powerful imperialist state? Of course, this is the case. And therefore, of course, we support the Palestinians unreservedly against this movie. It is quite monstrous what they did. Because the Hamas rockets killed, about a dozen people. The Israelis, in turn, they went in, they stormed in with all their superior forces. They killed, 1,300 were actually killed. Many more were wounded. And they completely smashed the infrastructure of Gaza. They haven't entirely destroyed the military the capability of Hamas, but they've seriously damaged it. You better believe it. And then the Hamas leaders come forward and say it's a victory. Good heavens above. A few more victories like that, and I don't know what's going to happen to the poor Palestinians. Well, it's not a victory. The Israeli imperialists achieved what they wanted, which were limited aims. It wasn't genocide or anything like that. They wanted to beat Hamas up, to smash Hamas as much as possible, to damage at least the capability of firing rockets, and I think they'll have to stop firing rockets. There was another warning the other day because the Israelis just withdrew. They weren't kicked out, they withdrew. Before Obama's inauguration, by the way. The timing was not an accident. Not now, we predicted that. That's what it's all about. They were making a point. They were making a point to Hamas. They were making a point to the entire, all the Arab world, if you like. And above all, they were making a point, a little point to Obama and Washington. Don't you believe that you can sell us out or do anything that we don't approve of behind our back, because it ain't going to work. Look what we can do when we choose. And they can do this whenever they choose. And having made this point, in a devastating way, in a very cruel way, because there's no need for me to dwell upon the terrible human consequences that goes without saying about how sympathies go out to the poor people always lose out in this game of chess, this game. The poor people, the poor Palestinians that lose, have their houses destroyed and so on. But they made a point. Now you see, Obama goes immediately to, or tries to open up negotiations with Iran. Bush was a little bit crazy, to be honest with you. This right-wing clique. They honestly thought they were drunk with power. They thought that they could do anything they wanted. We'll deal with Saddam Hussein, because they were after the oil. It was supposed to be... They wanted to plunder Iraq. Well, they haven't succeeded, because this war is costing them, and war is an economic proposition, after all. I think it's in the region of $2 billion a week. I think that's correct. And as we've said many times, not even the richest or the greatest or the most mighty power on earth can tolerate such a hemorrhage of blood and gold, because they're losing lives as well. They're losing a steady stream of American soldiers who have been killed, not to mention the huge amount of Iraqi civilians that have been slaughtered. And then they complain about the violence on the Gaza Strip when they've slaughtered men, women and children and many, many times over. In Iraq and Afghanistan. The hypocrisy of these gentlemen really is something to behold. But the Bush thought he was so clever. He thought he was going to impose the will of America everywhere. It's Syria. You're going to teach the Syrians a lesson. You're going to teach the Iranians a lesson. They thought they were so smart when they overthrew the government, the pro-Syrian government in Lebanon. They arranged a little coup. They overthrew it. Syria, however, the Syrian army, because it's still an oppressive force, we agree, but at least it kept the peace in Lebanon, which is a very fragile state. Once the Syrian element was withdrawn, of course, the whole thing degenerated again. Hezbollah gained, that's the only result of that little game. Hezbollah gained enormously. That led to the war with Israel. Israelis just too burnt their fingers in that war. They were also a bit too smart for their own good. Part of the reason why they invaded the Gaza Strip was to teach the Palestinians a lesson, and also to show the power. It is a deterrent force. By the way, think about this. Deterrence is not the same for the Israelis as it was for the Americans during the Cold War. That's a different sort of thing. The deterrence of two big nuclear powers was that it was precisely not to fight, just to gradually increase the amount of weaponry at your disposal and let the other guys know what you've got, but it actually preserved the peace in a twisted sort of way. The nuclear deterrent preserved the peace for about 50 years, or 40 or 50, 40 years at least, relative peace. But the deterrence for the Israeli imperialists is something different. They must occasionally show the enemy, the Arabs, that they mean business. This means by killing people, by slaughtering people, which they will do. Occasionally. And what they've done now. Now, the only thing is this. Obama, clearly what they will do now, there will be a period of discussion. There are differences between the imperialists also, by the way. So France, as usual, is playing its own game. France wants the oil, wants the deal with the Arabs, and therefore pretends to be sympathetic to the Palestinians. But they're all terrified. The Europeans in the first place are terrified at the forces that were unleashed by this business. Let's be clear also, let's just to finish this point, we've been speaking a long time on Gaza, there's no time. But let's be clear, people say, again, these same agitators, petty bourgeois, no, Israel is the same with the United States. Not so. It is true. What is true, what is perfectly true, and it's an important thing to bear in mind, is that in the present circumstance, Israel is the only reliable ally that the United States now has in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, of course, is hanging by a thread, so it's very unstable. They can't rely on Saudi Arabia. Egypt also, that's the point. Israel is the only power that they can, and therefore they can't go against Israel. That was the meaning of this little conflict. It's a warning. Don't you think that you can go behind our backs? We're the main players here. They need Israel, yes, and Israel needs the United States. Yes, that's true. They pay the bills, after all, and therefore the U.S. has got a certain leverage. Yes, but Israel is not the United States. It's the Israeli people have got their own interests, and they're very well aware that the Americans can sell them down the river at any time, or reach agreements that they don't approve of, and therefore they just wanted to make their presence felt. But in doing this, they upset the apple cart. They unleashed forces which nobody can control. Very dangerous forces from the standpoint of imperialism. These rotten, corrupt, reactionary Arab regimes like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Morocco, they're hanging by a thread. They're all hanging by a thread. And the world economic crisis, we must always come back to this basic point, has really upset the apple cart. The falling price of oil, well, just imagine the effect on the Saudis, who in the past were able to buy, to a certain extent, to buy social peace. It's a rotten, corrupt, stinking, reactionary regime. What effect do you think that will have? Iran deserves a separate discussion. I think there's no question. Iran is heading in the direction of a revolution. And the falling price of oil will have a devastating effect on Iran. Huge unemployment, particularly youth unemployment. Well, most of the population of Iran are youths anyway, young people anyway. Therefore, the whole area is like a tinderbox. It's like a powder keg that only needs a spark for the whole thing to go up. Egypt, in particular, is a candidate of the Arab countries, because Iran, of course, is not really an Arab country. It's a bit different also because it's got a different kind of Islam, Shiism.